This is an interview of January 27, 1998, with Jack Evans of LeGrand, Oregon.
Elsewhere, what was going on elsewhere, we used to drive out here when I was a kid and shop. And we used to also stay at Hot Lake. We had friends there, and my mother and I were both hospitalized there a couple times. But it really hasn't changed too much geographically since then. There was a mill out there where the wrecking yard is today. It was the Lone Pine Lumber Company. And the mill was on both both sides of the road, as I remember, and the maybe shavings or something were transported across the road on something that was overhead. The wigwam burner was right beside the road on the right as you go out there, and the foundations for it were still there until not too long ago when they reworked the intersection there.
About what year was that, Jack?
Oh, from 1933 to 1935 or 6. There was that mill. One question I was going to ask you, but I'll ask you when we go through here, was exactly when the George Palmer Lumber Company started. It was probably about 1905, because they didn't start drawing on their holdings around the Looking Glass area until 1908, when the railroad made it available to them. But I don't know if they did anything locally or not.
Well, it seemed like that their, you know, the big push to start with was that Palmer Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was, if I remember, like 1907 to 1912.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 7-year period, if I recall right.
Okay.
That they cut that whole thing out.
7 to 14, something like
about
that.
About 250,000 board feet.
Yeah.
Would have been like 1907 to 14.
That should be about right.
It would have been 5 to 12.
It seems
someplace right in there.
I'm not entirely sure about it, but it seems to me that when they ran the railroad on up the branch, they didn't build at all in 1908, and I think they, the year before, probably they at least got it far enough to for Palmer to use their holdings.
Mm-hmm.
And the Looking Glass is named after the creek, which is named after old Chief Looking Glass of Pashwaukite. But they had their little logging railroad that ran down to the ORNN at that point, Palmer Junction. And they, their camp number one was up the Looking Glass at the point where the fish hatchery is now. That was where their logging camp was. The area down in there beyond that, I don't know too much about, except that at the same time the Palmers were buying timberlands there. C.W. Nibley and his associates were buying up timberlands on Smith Mountain and various other places in Wallowa County. And probably about the time Palmers established Camp 5 on the Smith Mountain side of the river, and built their spur railroad line down the Vincent grade to the siding that was then known as Vincent, just north of Minam a little ways. At about that time, probably Nibley Memnaw was pretty well established. They built a mill in Wallowa in 1907, I think it was. And they had quite extensive holdings north and of Wallowa County, north of Wallowa. And they had a small logging railroad operation.
Yeah, because what it sounded like, the research I did, that like Palmer actually cut out Palmer Valley, then they moved to Smith Mountain and took about an equal volume off there.
I think that's probably correct. Camp 5 was quite an establishment in its day. And when Palmer, it may be a coincidence, I don't know, Vincent was named after Vincent Palmer, one of the family. But when George Palmer died in 1922, that may have been when they decided to sell the operation, I don't know. That was when Bowman Hicks, Kansas City-based outfit, bought them out. And and they operated the mill here for a time. There wasn't too much timber left, I don't think. And during the Depression, they shut down. And at the end of the Depression, I don't think they ever really reopened it. It was that was the end of the mill here. But in 23, Bowman Hicks bought the Nibley Memnaw Lumber Company and Wallowa Mill. And they operated it until 1945. And then sold out to the J. Herbert Bait Company of New York City.
The Bowman Hicks and LeGrand here, do you know if they pretty much just took over the Palmer Mill?
That's what they did.
Same location.
Yeah, they took over the Palmer Mill.
Palmer
Mill, I don't know exactly when they started, but I think it must have been the 1905 date that you have noted for that general operation. They had a fire in 1913 that burned the mill, and they rebuilt it immediately. And I don't know that it cost them too much in the way of operating time. Yeah, the Bait Company ran the mill in Wallowa until, I think it was 1961, that they had labor troubles and broke the union, ran the mill long enough to prove their point, and then shut it down and demolished it. The other mills around this area I don't know too much about, except Charles Fox's, of course. In 1881, I believe it was, Daniel Chaplin, who established the town of LeGrand, had two mills, one at Meacham and one at Hillgard. And the one at Meacham, interestingly enough, was acquired by C.W. Nibley, Grand Ronde Lumber Company. Nibley and Stoddard, and the Stoddards were Grand Ronde Lumber Company. In sometime early in the century, Nibley and the Grand Ronde Lumber Company acquired Chaplin's mill at Meacham and operated it. And then about, I think it was 1908 or 10, as soon as the Sumter Valley Railway reached Whitney Meadow, Nibley shipped the machinery over there and set up the mill at Whitney, which ran until about World War II.
That's out of Meacham.
And that was the mill at Meacham. That's where it went.
Well, it almost sounds like, of course, with the railroad going through in 1884, that Chaplin, that's why, you know, got the Hillgard of cutting, I would imagine, on the right-of-way.
Yeah, well, Chaplin had a contract with the railroad to supply, I've forgotten how many board feet of timber and lumber for all their various kinds of construction. And I think he was also maybe engaged in the tie cutting. He invested an awful lot of things.
Yeah, because you'd have tie cutting and trestles.
Yeah.
And, you know.
The people who settled up around Camila were nearly all tie cutters.
Do you recall, Jack, anything of like how they're cutting those ties, whether they were sawing or hewing them? Or?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't. I've wondered sometimes. And I wondered whether the first ones were shaped at all or not. They must have been, and I would have thought they probably hewed them square or rectangular.
You know. It sounds like, you know, hewed or hewed on at least two sides, because some of the red one place were like round on two sides. And then
once they established a mill that handled them, then, of course, they would saw them out, and you'd have mountains and mountains of slab wood and trimmings. Which would add a little bit to the fire hazard.
Oh, yeah. It make a lot of slab wood for fire. On the Grand Ronde within the valley itself, Jack, do you recall like vegetative types since you've been here?
Not much. Crossing the valley by car when I was little in the 30s, what I noticed mostly were that the farms were smaller by and large, had lots of windbreaks. It has only been in the last 40 years or so that you see the miles and miles of nothing at all, because the trees and the brush have all been eliminated in fence rows in order to get the highest yield feasible. which is good and bad. I used to joke about some fellow over by Union whose field blew away every winter and referred to it as our annual soil exchange program with Umatilla County.
Well, I still do that. Every time it dries out, the wind blows.
Yeah, and then you've got a real dust storm. But the river, it took them a long time to turn the whole thing into a canal between Oradell and Mount Harris, but they did get the job done. And I hadn't known until I read your material that it was the railroad that was responsible for a good deal of it, because they wanted to avoid having their yards flooded. Mm-hmm. And I imagine the city was happy about it, because they were kind of tired of having part of the downtown underwater every time there was a little bit of a spate. In the spring.
Some of the old pictures there show, like, you know, way up on Jefferson there, where, you know, it's flat out.
Yeah, there's that real nice picture of the Slater building that was down there, the one with the metal front.
Yeah.
It was built in 91. That was the 94 flood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sandbagged pretty heavily. But the river, as I remember it, and I only remember most of it, back the last 30, 40 years, but those channels out in the valley where they had originally begun as ditches had reached the point where the banks are 20 feet high and the water is 20, 30 feet across, you know, as they are in so much of the area. When I was in my teens, we came out here one time with a friend to hunt ducks, and it was the lower end of that big field that's just the other side of Reinhardt, right, just as the river goes around, it turns and goes into that gorge, that pretty little rocky gorge that the highway used to go through. There's that end of that field down there. At that time was all slough. They drained that part of it, and so that it's not any longer, but at that time, sluice in there were a perfect place to hunt ducks, because somebody rigged a blind in there, quite a nice one, with a wooden floor and a screen across the front, and you could sit there and have a cup of coffee and take a whack at a duck when they flew in. And there's, of course, nothing of that remaining today. It's
what
just
about
a big
the
field.
Type of vegetation that was in that slough area?
I don't remember anything different than what's there today. The same kind of brush, you know. More brush, probably, but I would imagine mostly willow and alder. And there, as I recall, there were probably more cottonwoods along the river at that time.
Yeah,
of course,
you get down in the gorge, there's quite a few cottonwoods. Seeing me, there used to be
The Heron Rookery is the relic of all of that, but it seems to me there was quite a bit more. The gorge was always a pretty little spot, and it hasn't changed much. You can't drive through it anymore.
But
it'd be nice if they would repave it and make a little scenic wayside through there. It'd be nice if they did that. But that part of the river, I don't think, has changed hardly any. If you were intimately connected with it locally, I suppose, any area, there would be pretty significant changes that somebody not acquainted with it wouldn't notice.
You get into, like, coming out of Union, there's a lot of cottonwoods from there, you know, upstream.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
The same way, the Grand, coming down to the park area.
Mm-hmm.
And then, do you call anything about how far out the valley the major, you know, were there a lot of cottonwoods compared to being...
I really can't remember. If we made side trips to Cove or anything like that, I don't remember them at all.
Mm-hmm.
We were probably in Union when I was little, because we drove to Burns, to Hines. I was probably 4 or 5 years old. And I really don't remember anything about that trip at all, hardly. Trips to Hot Lake were to there and back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We'd stay over maybe a weekend. But the thing I remember best about the trees around there, that avenue of cottonwoods that's along the foot of the hill where the spring ran, is still there.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful avenue to walk down, which we did when I was a kid. But the around the lake itself and from there out into the valley for quite a ways. It was kind of marshy, as it still is, but that's the kind of country that nothing much but brush would grow in. And I've forgotten when it was that they planted all those willows along the highway, but those were planted, the willows and the Russian olives, maybe during the 20s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, I doubt if anything but brush grew out there, yeah. Mostly willow and thorn. There are some of the things that have puzzled me for a time. You read expert opinions these days, and one of them tells us that red top grass, for example, is an introduced species, not native to the area. But the first pioneers through here were remarking that the red top grass in the valley was as high as a horse's belly, which makes me wonder a little bit just who introduced it.
Yeah.
And then there was the other one that anytime you see sagebrush, you're looking at overgrazed land that the sagebrush has moved into. But this leads me to wonder who, if it wasn't the cattlemen, who it might have been, because the earliest pioneers complained bitterly about the endless miles of sagebrush.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus even in the valley, out in those higher areas there, it was 1863 when Thompson surveyed. Mm-hmm. He'd making some notations there when he crossed, you know, and would go into some sagebrush areas, both northeast of Union there, and then out there towards the airport area.
Yeah, well, east of Baker, you know, for quite a distance, there's a lot of it.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. Craig Mountain, the lower slope, Rainbow Flat, that's all sagebrush. And I imagine it always was sagebrush.
Well, from the Powder River, you know, from there on south to Idaho, you know, in Nevada.
You're in semi-desert country, and that's where the sagebrush flourishes anyway.
But even, you know, in the valley here, as lush as it was, there's, you know, still evidently some sagebrush.
Yeah, there are a few patches of it.
Yeah.
The patch that's out there east of the airport, I think, has probably always been there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you should. One should assume naturally when you see a sagebrush that it's been overgrazed by cattle.
In 1863, there wasn't that many.
There weren't that many cattle around.
Leave that impact.
And who brought the red top grass in?
Do you recall, Jack, anything over since you've been here as far as like fish? You know, in the valley itself, was any of the salmon runs or steelhead runs?
Not a thing. Mm-hmm. I really don't. That was something that I never had any contact with or heard anything about. The only stories about the fish that I remember were the what they called the redfish that were the landlocked salmon in Wallowa Lake.
Mm-hmm.
That they were taken out of there by the barrels and are, of course, are long gone.
Mm-hmm.
But those are that's the only thing I remember. I remember we used to go up Bear Creek to the intake for the city water system and watch the salmon jumping in the spring. Don't know anything about it other than that, you see, so that's just a blank where I'm concerned.
Do you recall like going up above Le Grand, going out towards Hilgard, of the change in 1960 when they put the freeway in there, of anything during construction or change in vegetation up through the, you know, that area?
Not too much. At Hilgard, I can barely remember where the golf course was, just above the road there at what's now the weigh station.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the motel that was about where the weigh station is. And there was a gas station at Five Points. Mm-hmm. That was the name of the spot.
Mm-hmm.
The professional map makers, because they, I suppose it's because they don't know how to use apostrophes, but they have dropped all of them, and they're also trying to drop any S that looks like it might be a possessive from every title. So they now call it Five Point Creek, but it was always Five Points.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a gas station there, Five Points, right where the little bridge is, where the old road was, next to the freeway. And originally, the highway went on, the old Oregon Trail Highway went on up through Hilgard, and then up the side of the mountain and came out kind of up on top before you head across to Spring Creek. And the by the time I remember it, I think it had been changed so that it ran roughly where the freeway goes now.
Mm-hmm.
But when they put the freeway in, and when they put that highway in too, They made a lot of changes right there at what is now Hillgard Junction, where the Starkey Road takes off, where the park is. And they completely removed a sizable point of land that came down. That's the one that the Oregon Trail went up to get up on top. So if you cross the overpass there, you're about 40 feet under the trail, which is right above your head.
Yeah.
Was. If you're up above, you can follow it easily, and it, of course, just starts in midair up there.
You just have to do a little switchback to get up to that elevation.
But whether they did anything else to the river area there, I don't think they did. There was always a nice little spot there with cottonwoods, and that grove is still there. And the slope across the river that's been planted with pines more recently, that's where the center for the juveniles is. That area, it was a flat when I was younger, and that is the point where Stuart remarked about the echo in the canyon. But it's not changed any, so far as I can tell, substantially.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested on the old negative that it would have been looking probably from about where the freeway is, looking down across where the Hillgard State Park is, and the cottonwoods that are in there are really small. It was taken probably about 1910, I think, or something like that. Didn't have a date on it, but with the collection that it was the old Wright drugstore, the guy that probably he took it, or you know, had the in that collection.
When Wright might have taken it.
So it's kind of an interesting one to, I think, going back, you know, re-photographing that. You'd have to get up on the hill there, but showing the.
You might have to get a sky hook and hang it in the air if it was taken on that point.
But it's from that angle, back you know, and they're looking back.
It'd be interesting to see it.
It had the old trestle bridge going down to Grand Ronde, but for the road going up that way.
Did it have the railroad or your history?
That would have had been the road, because the railroad came up right along the river on the, you know, as you're going up there, it would be on the right-hand bank.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, like where you said that correction facility is, it would be across the river, you know. And,
yeah, it was over there.
The old CC camp, I guess, was right in there.
Yeah, it was on up the roadways. But further up, you get up toward the gun club, you can see where some more trestles were crossing the river up there.
But it just came out of Hillgard there, and they just held to that side of the bank, so they didn't have to cross it, you know, there for, you know, until they got farther up river.
Okay, well, I wasn't quite sure where it went, although I remember when they ended the logging railroad operation and Dad pulled up the tracks. We were going through there one evening at dusk on our way somewhere, and stopped because one of the engines was sitting there, and I saw that the other one had just been cut up into little pieces, but the engine that was sitting there still had steam up in it. It was cooling off, and they had been using it during the day, obviously.
Now,
that's the one that survives and is now down at Prineville.
Do you remember about what year that was, John?
Seems to me it was 49 or 50 or 51, but it may have been a little later.
Yeah.
It was right around 1950.
Yeah. Down in Boise Cascades, because I always thought, you know, they quit by that time. They said the last rail or short log that was hauled by rail was in 56, but unless they had some deck someplace, that, you know, and
they might have. I can't remember whether we were on our way back to Hermiston when we lived there, or whether it was earlier than that. It could have been 54 or 5,
yeah,
I suppose.
They came off 55, and they weren't hauling anything at that time.
No.
I still swear I saw the locomotives parked there at Hillgard, near Hillgard. But as far as rail cars, I never saw any sign of them.
No, there weren't any cars there at that time. They had just finished pulling up the track, and they were apparently using the locomotives in connection with that. And then they had already cut one up. They saved the other one, and they offered it to the city of La Grande, and La Grande, as might be expected, said, what would we want with something like that? So they ended up giving it to the Historical Society, and it sat at Oaks Park in Portland for quite a while. And then the Oregon Historical Society lent it to the Cass Valley Scenic Railway in West Virginia and forgot where it was. They forgot they even had it. And then not too long ago, they suddenly realized to their consternation that they had a locomotive out there somewhere, and they got a hold of the people in Cass Valley who had already cannibalized it for parts. So the people in West Virginia evidently found parts to put back on it, and then they sent it out here and received good working order, and I gather that the people in Prineville are doing scenic tours with it, which is nice. Beautiful engines.
I didn't like the shape of the audience, but
that was the only contact I had in any sense with the railroad logging around here. Mm-hmm. And of course the operation at Perry was long gone. Mm-hmm. The old, if anybody want to take a good look at a lumber camp, what's left up at Starkey camp, a lot of that's original. People use the little cabins for summer homes. They're beginning to show their age pretty seriously, but they're still there.
Yeah, big works camp. Do you recall, Jack, of anything up the Grand Run as far as fish runs? Or what about fishing with the both Indians or white man?
I never heard a thing. Mm-hmm. That's just something. I have fished myself up the Grand Run a little bit, and it's like present-day fly fishing anywhere. You know, it's not. Never remember any comments much about that sort of thing, except that what you usually hear, well, the fishing certainly isn't as good as it used to be. Mm-hmm. But that's about the size of it.
Some research I did there looked like, you know, the Grand Run had been worked over so much between the mining, the logging, and all that, you know, scarring out that. You lost a lot of the pools.
The only fishing I did in it, and that's only just a couple times, was after you get way up when it's starting to get to be fast water with rapids going down through the draw next to the road. That was when I got a few bites and caught a small fish or two, you know. But it, up there, it's more like it is, say, on the Lost Teen. Or something like that. You're above where it's mostly just, turbid water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What kind of fish were in there, Jack?
I don't know. Those were trout.
Trout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think rainbows. Mm-hmm. But the other fish, one of my friends, this is back in the 60s, around 1960, 59 maybe. He had a Model A Roadster, and we went down over to Grant Chandler's place. Grant's place was just on the other side of the river, and part of it was on the river. And we spent the nicest afternoon there with a six-pack of beer and plenty of worms catching suckers, and square mouths, as they were called. It was fun, and we filled a gunny sack with them. And we brought it home, and his dad planted it all around things in the garden, and planted a bunch of them around the rose bushes, and the rose bushes were enormous for a few years. I think more could be done in the way of garden fertilizer if people would bother to catch lots of suckers.
Might help the fishing too.
Mm-hmm, that might help. The Andromas fish might help out a little bit if we... use the suckers for fertilizer.
Do you recall, Jack, anything of ever hearing anything about them logging lodgepole or cutting lodgepole, not lodgepole, but cottonwood?
No, I saw your question there, and the Victors had a mill over in Wallowa, and they cut cottonwood for a while, and knives had to be good and sharp if they planed it. It's fuzzy, you know, and if you can get it cured without it warping or tying itself in knots, and you finish it nicely, it can be a rather pretty lumber. And they had some that was really nice, you know, fancy figure and everything. But with them, I think it were more a novelty than anything else. And nowadays we're getting some plantations because poplar is not acidic. And it's makes it so much better paper than what we have now that turns brown and crumbles in no time at all.
Yeah.
You get all this nice white paper to make your photocopies on, and you file it for a couple of years and you go back and it's already breaking in two. Well, a lot of it is the kind of thing you don't want to keep any longer than that, if that long. Nonetheless, it would be nice to have a better access to non-acidic paper for things that you don't want to deteriorate. And I would think that
facts,
but all of the cottonwood I ever saw cut, really, and I'm sure that was true around here, they cut it to get rid of it, and they did their best to get it burned up and done with, and you'd see these huge piles of old roots and ashes out in the fields.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There, it's was never considered, I think, a commercial proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays it might be.
Yeah, but,
they're a very pretty tree along a stream. It's not nice to have one in your yard. They're awfully messy, but they're from a little distance. They're really pretty.
That's real lot of shade for the stream.
Lots of shade.
Yeah, it's out there in the valley too, where the that other rookery of blue heron, that great blues.
Oh, that's
Catherine Creek.
Off of Catherine Creek, northeast of Hot Lake.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was all marshland, and it's been drained fairly recently with the canals put in by the Corps of Engineers, and I think probably to the detriment of the area. It looks like it's mostly alkali. I don't know whether it really is or not, but I've often thought that if you won $1 billion, it'd be nice to acquire all that and get rid of all the ditching and breach all the dikes and raise the biggest mosquitoes in Oregon.
Right. Well, the of course, out there at Latin Mars, they've increased their holdings to now sold over 3,000 acres.
Mm-hmm. I saw that figure. I didn't know how much that it had grown, but I'm glad they've done it. And over across the road, just south of the wrecking yard, I understand they now own a large chunk in there that they're hoping to develop. I'm not sure just what they can do with that. It's all just a big featureless flat.
Mm-hmm.
But they might be able to put in ponds or something over there.
I don't know what their total, long-term plans are, whether they're even used for trading for master, and something.
Yeah, it might be that they could do that.
Could ask them, it's not whether they're pursuing it, but if there's opportunity for this, or, so they can try and get on.
Yeah, I think that refuges are really, as a real asset to the county, to the valley.
Trying to pull back some of the, marshland. Waterfall.
It's almost gone almost too far one way. Of course, we, as a species, we have a way of going to extremes over just about everything.
Well, that's you wouldn't know how to act if you didn't. Have to wait till it's almost disaster.
And unless you're on the outside looking in, that's where I usually try to be.
Well, it's like the Willamette right now. They're concerned. They only went through that where the Willamette was.
They cleaned it up once. Now they're hoping to clean it up again, and they're deciding they're going to have to drink out of it. So maybe they'd better.
Start getting a little smarter. Everybody.
Now you think of the Columbia and what it and this the snake and the others that run into it, what they've been through, and the water can't be very good by the time it hits the Pacific Ocean. And over on the Snake, Shoshone Falls is one of the most magnificent cataracts in the world, really. And if you go to see it, you want to see it before the 1st of May.
Mm-hmm.
Because during the summer, they draw all the water out of the Snake River, and you see all these cliffs with a few little trickles running down them, and that's all there is.
Well, when you're there, you have to be there when it's young.
Now, you got to be there before they start irrigating. You don't see it.
It's pretty spectacular.
Oh, yeah. The cataract itself is tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Have to cover your lens with all the mist in the air.
But that just tells you, if they irrigated to the extent that it all soaked in or vanished out or evaporated out their way, that'd be the end of the Snake River there.
That kind of fills me in, kind of going to those.
You really need somebody that's spent their whole life here, and been closely acquainted with all of that sort of thing.
Unfortunately, there's not too many left.
Yeah, there aren't too many.
Yeah, getting the age
I think of people who were here when we first moved here. We came here in 56. And any number of them told interesting stories about the early days. That was where I heard about the valley being so flooded the one year when you could row a boat all the way to Union. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure which year it was. I thought it might be the 94 year, but I see from your work that it's the 63 one.
Well, that was one year. You know, of course, earlier.
There are a bunch of them.
Yeah, because there's quite a few, you know, that predated that. Mm-hmm. We had that, you know, real heavy floods across the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they're way back, well, before the turn of the century.
Right.
You know, 1894. Or someplace in there, I'd have to look again at the date.
Mm-hmm. 94 was a big one.
Yeah. And then there's hell one, remember on Catherine Creek, it seemed like, you know, in the teens there in the 20s, you know, that every little whip stitch would be another flood.
Yeah.
Another big one.
The Corps of Engineers has always had it in mind to dam every running stream everywhere. I mean, once you get started as specialists, you want to continue your specialty. And the Corps' only interest, really, for a long time was in building more dams.
Well, if they could have, they'd do it on every stream that existed.
I think so.
That was their agenda.
They keep getting their appropriations that way. And, the map I've seen, their projected work, it's a detailed map of the whole this region, mm-hmm. The Northwest, and every streamlet has a row of little blue lines across, mm-hmm. so that you get one pool finished, you put in another dam.
Yeah.
And they were—I remember a fellow was here representing the Corps, nice guy too. He was checking out the proposed reservoir on Catherine Creek, just above the park, and I went with him. He wanted to know about any pioneer or other structures that might be there, and I pointed out some cabins in the area and said it seemed a real shame to flood a beautiful meadow like that for no other reason than to provide trash fish for people who like to float in boats. And he said, well, it would help with floods. And I said, I don't think the floods are probably serious enough to warrant the kind of expenditure and tax dollars that you'd be looking at. But of course, my opinion that wouldn't mean anything to them, you know. It was just a chance to say something.
Right.
And I certainly wasn't aggressive toward him. He was a nice guy doing a careful job.
Mm-hmm.
And he took pictures and things like that. But the fortunate thing from my point of view, and that's a selfish one, is that the Indians complained. It was a place where they had camped and fished in the past, mm-hmm. evidently, and they didn't want to see a dam put in there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And their word would carry a lot more weight than mine would these days.
Well, I got into it on their side in the court there, and when they had that about the to stop that one,
mm-hmm.
I got into it.
It seemed to me it'd be a dreadful thing to do to put a dam in there, and they wanted to put one in where the that big wide spot is up the Grand Ronde. There's a farmhouse up there, and I think the National Guard has a shooting range at the far end of it.
By the shooting range, the gun club there, Jack?
Not the one with the gun club. It's the one further up that the National Guard uses.
I knew it was up in there.
They had that great big wide meadow up there. And they wanted to dam that.
Mm-hmm.
And some people I knew thought it would be a wonderful idea because here all the boating you'd have up there would be real close by and handy. But again, I didn't really see that it would do any good. And if you've got a really bad year, they're not much good for flood control because the pools are all full and they're all going to have to run over anyway.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't stop anything. Is that Tom? That must be Tom.
Yeah,
it is Tom. But
because they had some of that, like up there, the dam at Perry, when the Hampshire sawmill, when the mm-hmm. guys got in there and broke loose, you know, came down, took out Ordell there, right at mm-hmm. the mouth of the canyon.
Yeah.
Took out quite a few buildings.
The dams for that kind of operation are usually not intended to be permanent, mm-hmm. so they aren't quite as strong as a permanent structure would be, and their chances of them washing out is a little greater.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other places where dams were contemplated.
Well, they were like over at Elgin. They were looking at a big one over there.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Because they went through in the 40s. They had a list of all these different places.
They were going to put in hundreds of dams. Mm-hmm. I remember about that.
The one in Elgin, I guess what it was, they finally lost interest. You know, they started looking at how much it's going to cost and what the benefits were.
It is for spares, but damn, just a useless aside. But they were there was a good deal of talk about putting a dam up the Grand Ronde and one up Cashman Creek, and I think some of the farmers thought that would be helpful. I'm not sure just why, but it applied to what something they were doing. Anyway, I wrote a letter to the paper suggesting that we should set our sights a little higher and not be such pikers, and we should put in a dam 300 feet high between Pumpkin Ridge and Mount Harris. And that way we could sell the beachfront property in Cove for high prices and get the excursion tour to up Deal Canyon.
We have all the water in the world, but irrigate.
You have a park like that. Make it handy lake.
Oh, you bet.
I don't know what you'd use it for.
Like Lake Powell or Yellow Road.
I don't know what you'd use it for, but you'd have it.
Yeah. You could have the excursions out there in this day and age. You could water skiing, do all sorts of good things.
Yeah. Or troll for alligators, as they refer to it in the South. Oh my.